Next case we're going to hear is Everett versus Pitt County Board of Education. Mr. Dorison, when you're ready, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The district court in this case committed errors of law in failing to assign the burden to the school board to prove that its 2011-2012 assignment plan furthers the board's affirmative duty to remedy the continuing vestiges of race discrimination. This error of law irrevocably taints any potential or purported substantive findings the court has made. Additionally, the court's ruling below misconstrues the unique nature of school desegregation precedents and the affirmative burden on a non-unitary board. The school board's response to the motion below tried to reframe the posture of this case as if they were already unitary and that the plaintiffs had to show intentional discrimination. The district court accepted that.
Let me just interrupt because I sense that the arguments are being made on a structure that nobody seems to agree on in this case. The arguments about preliminary injunctions and permanent injunctions and burdens of proof. And I must say, I'll tell you what I see, and then you can tell me if I'm wrong. This litigation has been going on for over 40 years. And in 2009, the parties settled the case and entered in consent order. The consent order says, number one, the settlement is approved, putting an end to the cases. Number two, the court, and I'm quoting, orders the parties to work toward attaining unitary status. And number three, the court further orders the parties to submit this report at the end of this year, December 31. Settlement order with those three orders. The case is closed. The only thing, there's no new action filed. Your case comes in and basically says, Your Honor, they're not complying with the consent order. Now, when you don't comply with a consent order, you can ask for contempt, you can ask for injunctive relief, you can ask for some damages, you can ask for a declaration, you can even ask that the case, that the consent order be vacated and the whole case is opened up, I suppose. But in this case, you come in and file an injunction and say they are not working toward attaining unitary status, which is one of the provisions of the order. Inherently, your motion is nothing more than a motion to declare that they're breaching the order or to force them to comply with the order. And if I were the district judge in that case at that time, I might have done what this judge did, which is to find the facts and see whether they're progressing appropriately, and he found that they did. Or he could have said, let's wait until the end of the year and I'll evaluate it then. That would have been the more prudent. But the long and short of all what I'm just telling you, what I see on this record, is that your action is in the existing case where there's a consent order, and you're doing nothing more than challenging whether they are complying with the consent order. And that could be a motion for breach, motion for whatever. You ask for an injunction, that's okay too. But it's not a permanent injunction, it's not a temporary injunction. It's an injunction to carry out the consent order. The judge rejected your motion, and it seems to me we're just now here to review his findings of fact for clear error and his ultimate decision for some kind of abuse of discretion. And this business, and you have the burden of demonstrating there was a violation because you initiated it. We're not, don't have relative harms, and we don't have the potential for this and the status quo. There's no status quo. There is an order that directs you and the other party to work towards attaining a unitary status. And they've been working toward that. And the judge looked at it, and you think their work is fruitless because they're not doing the right thing. So the judge looks at it and says, they're on progress, order's not breached, and you still have, at the end of the year, the opportunity to come in and challenge as part of that report. Now, if they totally fail, the judge, I assume, can say this consent order has not been complied with, and I'm going to vacate it, and we'll go do something else. But it sounds to me either you're premature or you've got an uphill burden so great that it's hard for you to make unless the fact-finding on this ongoing breach is clearly erroneous. But I've said all that. I've spoken too long, and I'm happy to have you comply, but I don't think it's fruitful to talk about preliminary injunctions and permanent injunctions because there's no action open. The action was closed. We have a consent order, and all we have is a court supervising its consent order. And you're acting in response to that. Isn't that aspect correct, that last part?
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. And the 2009 order, though, as you pointed out, specifically states that the district has not achieved unitary status. And
it doesn't matter. It says the cases are settled. The two long-standing cases are settled. And then it says this in full. The court orders the parties to work toward attaining unitary status. To work. That's all they're ordered right now. So that the court may relinquish jurisdiction over this case and restore to the school board full responsibility for the operation of the schools. So at this point, before the end of the year, the only order is that they work toward a unitary status. At the end of the year, you can challenge them, because it says, and then it orders the parties to submit on or before December 31, 2012, a report detailing the school board's efforts. That's when they're going to be measured. And I think everything you've put in here can still be put in as part of that challenge to the year-end status. But at this point in time, you can only be arguing that they're not working toward attaining unitary status. And that's fair enough. So you file a motion that the order has been breached. They're not moving toward attaining a unitary status. The court said they are. And that's where we're here today. And it seems to me your appeal has to be that the court was wrong in concluding that they are working towards unitary status at this time. But I'm not sure there's much more to argue. This injunction business, and I'm pretty familiar with injunctions.
Yeah, I don't want to argue the injunction. I want to argue exactly what you are saying, Your Honor, which is they are still under a court order. And with all due respect, the settlement that is described in the 2009 order is the settlement of a unitary status motion that was made by the plaintiff interveners. The court's own order does not say it disposes of the big case, the school desegregation case, which is at the core of this. And in fact, it says just the opposite. It says the district has not achieved unitary status, and it says
that's the background, but the order is a consent order that ends it. The court administratively closed the case.
Subject to being reopened on motion of any party.
It has continuing jurisdiction because there's two ongoing duties. One is to work toward attaining status, and the other is to give a report when you can challenge it and say it's not worked.
And our motion was to show that they are not moving towards unitary status.
Fair enough.
Fact,
that's fair
that,
enough.
That, that they're moving away.
That complaint is sort of like an anticipatory breach complaint. They're not in the process of attaining it. If they were doing nothing, you could go back to the court and say, hey, they're doing nothing. So the court reviewed your motion and with some fact-finding concluded they are moving toward it. And that it'll review it at the end of the day. Now, I don't know if the court's facts are wrong, but if its facts aren't wrong, it's pretty hard for you to say the court looking at that isn't concluding that the parties are working toward attaining. Didn't say they'd attained it.
Sorry.
I mean, the measure of attainment is going to be on December 31.
The court's error was in the way it analyzed our motion and whether or not the district is moving toward unitary status.
Well, you complained about the burden of proof and so forth, and it's not a burden of proof problem. It's a fact you came in and made a motion, and you have to carry the burden on demonstrating your motion. And if they're not working to unitary status, you get some relief. If they are, end of the question.
Well, the history of school desegregation law, which I'm sure you're well familiar with, and the controlling precedents for this case are unique.
We're not in a discrimination case. We're in a case challenging a consent order and nothing more.
Well, I respectfully would disagree with that, Your Honor. This school desegregation case is still open until the court declares the school district unitary.
God, because, I mean, this case is not in a vacuum. There are other cases, particularly in North Carolina, that has addressed this sort of situation. The Charlotte system, I believe, is Mecklenburg County, has now achieved unitary status. And if I understand your point in this case, it is that the 1970 case is the case that is really still on the board. Working toward unitary status is something you do all the time. I mean, that was the purpose, to work toward unitary status. The fact that the judge says do it. It simply is something you're already doing anyway. And the fact that you've settled that particular action that now comes up in the subsequent action simply indicates that unitary status has not been achieved. So that, at least from your perspective, what that does, it determines what the review of this case will be and how you will review it and who has the burden, so to speak. And if I understand your perspective, that's what the problem is. The problem is who has the burden here and how do you proceed in terms of attaching that burden. And did the district court, in fact, apply a preliminary injunction standard in doing so, which I think Judge Niemeyer and I both probably agree that's not the proper way to do it. Is that the basis upon which you're proceeding, or is there more?
That is the basis, Your Honor. And as this court noted in Vaughn's, in a very similar case where a school district took actions that community members alleged moved away from unitary status. It was also a district that was still in a pre-unitary state.
The significance here is who has the burden. Do you get rid of the burden by simply saying work toward that which you're already supposed to be working toward and have it to me by the end of the year, and therefore somebody else gets the burden as opposed to you? Or do you still stick with the 1970 order, which is clearly there on the book and is an order that's there as to how it's done and who has it if you're going to change anything? So I think that if you address in terms of who has the burden, that seems to be significant in deciding which way to go in this case.
And I think the precedents are clear that until a unitary status declaration is issued by the court, until there's a finding that this school district has remedied the vestiges of discrimination, then that burden is still on them. And the cases from Freeman and Dayton, court's...
Yeah, but see, the court procedurally established a mechanism to resolve all these cases and return full control to the board. And the mechanism was, as of November 2009, it was requiring at that point that they continue, and it gave them the latitude to keep working toward unitary status, but it gave them a deadline. And it says, report that you've accomplished your task on December 2012. There's this point for you to come and say they're not working toward unitary status, you have the burden, not that they hadn't attained it. Your burden is to show that they're not even working toward it. And the court pointed out that they're building a school here, the geographical location of the elementary school here, went through some statistics, and to argue that they're not working toward it has to be your claim. You have to carry the proof, you have to demonstrate they aren't working toward it. And if you carried that burden, then you should, maybe he should open it up and say, hold it, this isn't working.
Well, and that's what we argue the court should have done. We came forward with evidence in the record that they're moving away from unitary status. And again,
the court didn't agree, right?
But they applied the wrong burden of proof. The burden on a school board that has not been declared unitary is to show that the changes that they make move the district towards unitary status.
That burden, and now they are told to be doing it now. And you can't challenge it until the end. They're not told to attain it. They're told to work toward it. And you're the one that's challenging the timetable. You're coming in saying, before the end, you're saying they're not doing it.
Two points on that, Your Honor. One, the 2009 order, by virtue of imposing a reporting requirement in 2012, does not change the pre-unitary status of this district. It doesn't create some kind of bubble in which a pre-unitary school district is insulated from its traditional burden of proof or its affirmative constitutional obligation.
In other words, what you're saying is that a non-unitary school district, there's a burden that the court has clearly established. You don't get a hiatus by simply a court saying, well, work toward it in the future, in that interim period there. Even though working toward it in the future, even if it happens in December, there's no order that happens in December. There's a report that comes in. So you don't get this little hiatus to discriminate or to violate a desegregation order in that time period. You still have the burden under the 1970 order until it is declared a unitary system to be outside of that burden. You don't lift it by saying in the future you will give me a report. He could have said 10 years from now. And you don't get 10 years now to do the things that would be in violation of the desegregation order until you get a report. It is when you get that report, then you are lifted and the burden comes from it.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and that's the point we tried to make at the court below. Additionally, there are students subject to this reassignment plan who are now suffering the real, immediate, and irreparable harms of being in more racially isolated schools than they should otherwise be in.
Well, let me ask you about that.
To the court's order.
I agree with you that the judge simply applied the improper burden, incorrect burden. I suppose the remedy is this case goes back down to the district court to figure out what to do about it. But here we are in January. The school year is well underway with respect to this plan. You just mentioned that you have students suffering under what you believe to be a discriminatory or impacted plan. What's the district court supposed to do about that?
Well, ideally, the district court will, with instructions from this court, will hold the school board accountable to its affirmative burden and determine...
Accountable going forward?
Accountable immediately. And that while this school system, this school year has already begun, there's another school year starting in August. And the school board must be able to show that the actions they've taken...
That order that it gives them to the end of the year... And you consented to that, and that wasn't appealed. And so the court says we have not reached unitary status. We're going to have them continue working. Everybody agrees. And we're going to then measure how they did with a report card at the end of the year. That's what everybody agreed to, unappealed order. It doesn't eliminate the underlying cases, but it provides the mechanism by which this is going to be resolved. So before the end of the year comes up and you say they're not doing what they were supposed to do under the order. And the answer is, he said, they are.
And by not holding them to their affirmative obligation, the burden of proof that's been established in every school desegregation case that's come down from this court and the Supreme Court.
I guess you didn't hear my question then. I mean, sure, they have the burden of attaining that. But that was resolved with a mechanism to let them, give them time to work, and you agreed to it. And we didn't get an appeal on that. That's the order. And they have until, they have to work to on this effort, and they have until the end of the year to accomplish it and report.
But they're in violation of the order.
Fair enough. To me, that's our claim.
Yeah. And they retain the ultimate burden of proof to show that they are moving towards and ultimately have attained unitary status. And they have not been asked by the court below to do that. The court below treated this as if we had to prove there was some kind of intentional discrimination. And the board's response is framed as if they were being charged with intentional discrimination. And that is not the standard under any of the cases.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Sue.
May it please the court. I have with me at counsel table Deborah Stagner, who is on brief in this case. Plaintiffs are fundamentally confusing, and I'm glad that Mr. Dorison used the term, our obligation to reach unitary status and the evidentiary burden on their motion. There is an obligation from an evidentiary point of view for a public school system that is not unitary to show when they're asking for approval of a desegregation plan or when they're asking to exit from unitary status, that they have the burden to show that they have in fact eliminated the vestiges of discrimination. However, as Judge Niemeyer pointed out, in this case, when plaintiffs are basically seeking enforcement of an order or alleging civil contempt, it is their burden. One of the cases that they cite, Diaz versus San Jose, specifically says plaintiffs did not fulfill their burden under their motion. The case had a different posture. The first time that the Dowell versus the Oklahoma City Schools case went up to the 10th Circuit, the 10th Circuit specifically said that you are challenging the court's order from some time in the past, you have the burden of showing that there is a violation. We absolutely agree, and we understand that we are under a timetable and a plan that requires us, gives us an obligation.
Do you accept the notion that when it comes time to report, you have the burden of demonstrating that you have attained the goals that are set forth, the unitary status goals?
I absolutely agree with that proposition. Okay. There's no question.
That's what the order does.
And
it doesn't take that burden away from you. But it tells you that you have a time period within which to do this and when to report. And this action now challenges on an interim basis whether you're doing a good job.
Exactly, Your Honor. And again, we get confused when we use this word burden, which can apply in a lot of different contexts in school desegregation cases, the burden on one population or the other, the burden of proof, the school system's burden to move forward. The other thing, in terms of the...
I think it's important, though, to have at least in context the 1970s order. And in fact, I think you would agree that in a non-unitary system, there is a burden that is basically on your clients in that instance. And then beyond that, there is also a presumption because of the past discrimination that has existed there, a presumption that exists against you. And you have to overcome that when there are allegations that there are disparities with the system and we just seek to create a plan. The question is the settlement, and maybe that's where we're reaching the point of judicial choice in this question, is does the settlement settle the 1970s order when it did not, in fact, include a order of unitarity?
In the sense that we were not declared unitary, and in fact, the context of this, of the current phase of this case, which was dormant for 35 years, is we asked for it to be reopened because we had a complaint that in our 2005 redistricting, we used satellite busing to improve, we hoped, to improve the diversity at several inner city schools that were in fact part of the old Greenville City School System. The Office for Civil Rights said, we don't think you can do that anymore, basically because those orders are too vague and in the past and they've been achieved and so on and so forth. So we went back into court. Once we did, plaintiff interveners came in and said, no, you're unitary already. This is all academic, and asked the court to put that aside. We asked that all be put aside. The court said, no, you need to keep working. So I'm getting a little bit off point here, but when you say, We have a burden. I would really say we have a legal obligation to remedy past discrimination. But when you talk about Judge Larkin's orders in the 70s, those orders were not very prescriptive going forward. They had a number of schools were combined, so there'd be one set of grades from two formerly segregated schools at one of the schools and then the higher set at the other. There were a number of things like that, but there was no ongoing prescription, as, for example, in the Pasadena case, where the judge said, from now on, every year you have to readjust your student assignment so that there is no majority of a minority at any school. We didn't have that. So again, they lay dormant, and when Judge Howard came in, basically he said, these are the ground rules you're going forward on. Your student assignment policy is approved with the removal of racial diversity, the 70-30 racial diversity target that used to be in there, and gave us a groundwork for going forward. So I agree that we're clearly not unitary, but in terms of whether there is a continuing obligation from Judge Larkin's orders, there really isn't. I mean, the one you could argue still exists is in the...
Continuing obligation to eliminate discrimination. There's not that in that order, you say?
No. There's no specific... statement about how to go about, for example, assigning students from year to year.
But you do have the continuing obligation to eliminate discrimination.
Clearly we do.
Order. And if it is failing in the particular assignment plan that you have, isn't that in violation of the 1970 order?
Well, let me address plaintiff's contention on that point. Basically, their entire...
Address my question on it. I understand the contention. I mean, if you have enacted, if what you have is in, does not work toward to eliminate discrimination in violation of the 1970 plan, isn't that what we're dealing with here?
I agree. I mean, that's the whole definition of our obligation
as
a.
You have to show that in fact it does not do that. That the plan itself, because the 1970 order didn't say you couldn't bring another desegregation plan, you can. But when you do, you have to meet certain requirements. Isn't that really what the problem is?
When we move for a determination that we're unitary status in any or all of the factors that are relevant, it will clearly be our burden of proving that we've eliminated the vestiges of past discrimination.
But in the interim, are you then free to discriminate freely? I guess that's the problem. They're suggesting that this plan, the 2011-12 plan, not only doesn't move toward unitary status, it moves away from unitary status and perpetuates the problems that resulted in the 1970 orders to begin with.
We're not suggesting that at all. They had remedies in the district court. I mean, part of the larger context of it is the district court has retained jurisdiction, has a deadline coming up. What is their burden in seeking enforcement of the 2009 order in terms of a factual showing? And we contend, again, going back to not the legal burden, which we clearly have, going back to the sort of burden of proof, they've got a burden of showing we're in violation of those orders. That's not to say, of course, we can be held accountable and should be held accountable for not complying with that.
Yes, I'm having trouble understanding that, given that the court back in 1970 said that you were not in violation, but you hadn't you were discriminating. That's a finding that exists in the record, and it remains so until you prove otherwise. And in the interim, what these folks have done is come to the court and said that this particular plan is in violation of that order. It seems to me at that point it's on you to prove to the court why it isn't.
Well, again, under the Dowell case and just under sort of general principles of jurisprudence, they brought this motion forward. I mean, they just have the burden of making some showing that we're in violation. Otherwise, so every decision that we make that might have some relevance to desegregating the school system, we suddenly have this shifted burden of proof. Anybody comes in, we have to make an affirmative showing. As Justice Scalia said in his concurrence in the Freeman versus Pitts case, that's putting school systems in the sometimes impossible position of attempting to prove a negative. I mean, I'd be happy to turn to our view that based on our limited evidence, our opportunity to put evidence in the record, they didn't meet a burden. We did meet a burden. I mean, I think if you put the burden on us, we still met it. And if you look at the system, this, 40 years on, you look at a lot of school systems that are under a DSEG order, and Charlotte Mech would be one example. 40 years on, there is significant and problematic and impossible to deal with resegregation of the school system. If you look in the appendix, the record in this case, we have a school system that largely, the majority of schools are within that old 70-30 target ratio.
But the Charlotte-Mecklenburg system is out of it now, right?
Well, I'm talking about, and respectfully, Your Honor, during the period when the Belk case was being hammered out.
And really, what I'm trying to get at an understanding is, it would seem to me either a school has achieved a unitary status, and therefore you're out of it, but if you're under it, the rules of the 1970 case order are pretty firm. I mean, it tells you what the presumption is, it tells you what the burden is, it tells you if you're going to change these plans, you got to show this has happened. And if you get something in the interim, a little settlement that said, okay, we're going to move forward on it, and then we're going to get a report, it doesn't change the obligation on the part of the school board to that the presumption that's against it, because and it all stems from because there's a historical basis for the discrimination that underlied the 1970s orders, and there's a reason why this extra type of burden is put on you, and you want to get out from under it, then you seek to get the unitary status. Once you do, you then can go forward.
And clearly that burden, the fundamental part of that burden is to redress past segregation. That burden in all matters, for example, seeking enforcement on a judgment, doesn't include that the burden of proof shifts to us on any question. Even if it did shift to us, as I said, we have 40 years on a school system that you couldn't look at the numbers that are presented, for example, in the projected enrollment under the current assignment plan and say this is an intentionally segregated school system. There are some schools that are more out of line, there are some schools that are less out of line.
Well, I don't know that the record is fully developed. This comes up on a motion for a preliminary injunction. In the normal course of things, you would have a full-blown hearing on that issue, wouldn't you?
As in the Charlotte case, it lasted for months. I'm not hoping for that in this case, but I'm sure it's going to go on for a while when we get to that point. Even so, in the truncated opportunity we had to present evidence, we presented evidence that Lake Forest, which is the school of primary concern, which is approximately 12% white, and then, of course, we have a different student population dynamic, but approximately 80% African American, is one of three schools that are built in a high-growth corridor to the east of Greenville. Two of them, Ridgewood and Creekside, are more balanced. This one is closest in to the more urban population areas. The reason that that school, and so basically what plaintiffs say is, because you could have implemented satellite busing to make this school more diverse, that is proof that you are regressing. The truth is, the evidence, Aaron Bolyu's affidavit and other sources of information show that it is a function of demographics. During a five-year period that's reflected in the record we have here, 1,000 kids were added to a 22,000 student school system. There was tremendous growth. Most of it's in that part of the county. They cited schools based on where kids are appearing with expert assistance from North Carolina State.
Let me ask you about another procedural question. If this order, this 2009 settlement order, had not been part of the record, let's just say you're proceeding along, you propose this assignment plan, which is the subject of the plaintiff's discontent, they object, they come before the district court. Whose burden is it?
I think that it would be their burden to show that we were in violation of the 1970, whichever order they were.
Notwithstanding the fact that you haven't yet achieved unitary status, still their burden.
I agree that it would still be their burden to show that. I mean, clearly we have the obligation to achieve unitary status.
Well, that's true to the extent if you don't seek to make another plan. If you seek to bring a plan in, it's not their burden to show that that plan is about. It's yours to show that it is in compliance. And I think it is clear from Judge Howard's order that he didn't lift the 1970 desegregation orders. He posits that it's time to do so, and he sort of sets out a framework to do so, but those orders are in full force. And for you to implement a plan in that is allegedly in violation of the 1970s orders, the settlement doesn't cure that, because the orders still require that it be done in a way such that it does not continue or promote the discrimination that is historical.
Judge Wynn, I absolutely agree with you that if we came to the court with a plan that we said, we want you to approve this plan, Your Honor, or we want you to approve the notion that we have achieved unitary status, we have the burden of making that showing. If we bring a desegregation plan to the court, the plan here, and again, we have to be precise about what plans we're talking about, was a student assignment plan for the purpose of filling Lake Forest. Now, I absolutely agree that in doing that, the board has an obligation to address.
What was the 2006-2007 plan referred to in the 2009 order?
That was a plan that, among other things, addressed capacity at a new middle school that sort of created a chain of the need to reassign across portions of the school.
And there was a revised policy 10.107.
The attendance area policy, which Judge Howard approved in the 2009 order, previously said that we will seek that the diversity was defined only as racial diversity. And it also set a target of no more than 70-30 percent minority-majority of any of the two major races in the county. The revised policy incorporated in the definition of diversity, socioeconomic status, achievement, a number of other factors, and put other factors in assignment, including proximity, bus transportation, and so on. And it removed that racial diversity target. That's what all the parties agreed to. That's what Judge Howard approved.
Is there any plan other than the 2006-2007 and the revised policy?
Any other
plan student that you're working under? Yeah.
There is currently no other student assignment plan pending that I'm aware of. this was to populate a school that has not been populated.
I'm trying to, in view of the questions that you're getting from all three of us, I'm trying to figure out procedurally where we are. And as I understand it, Judge Howard clearly didn't lift the 1972 orders.
That's
and,
clear.
Is working against those, and that the county had adopted a 2006-2007 student assignment plan and a revised policy. And that it was presented to Judge Howard to resolve the duties in carrying out the 1972 orders. And that was approved, the parties agreed to that, and Judge Howard approved that. And so the final step in bringing the 1972 orders to an end was to have you now work against those plans towards unitary status and then have you report and demonstrate that you completed it by the end of the year. Is that a correct procedural understanding?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And in answer to what I think may have been your question about a plan, there is a plan and a process undergoing on all the factors, and of course, whether it's Green or another case that we look to for how you, what you need to show for a unitary status showing, but attempting to address things. And there is, in fact, evidence in this record that on the Green factor of staff assignment, part of the plan is that all schools where there is a deviation from the system's achievement levels, measured by the most critical, by reading, which is the hardest one, has been the hardest one for them to get kids up to level, they will have these special teacher scores of particularly highly qualified teachers with a record of success. So that is in part, that is part of the effort to comply with the 2009 order and show not just in student assignment, but in all these areas that are important that we are in compliance. And again, in terms of whether plaintiff has the ability to address our alleged failure to comply with the order or failure to comply with the Constitution, they do. In this case, the judge applied, whether preliminary injunction was the appropriate vehicle or not, I'll leave it to the court to decide, he applied the proper burden in making that determination. Even if he put in the even if he had placed the burden on us, we demonstrated that the deviation in diversity at Lake Forest was not a function of past discrimination, it was a function of geography, housing patterns, and areas of student growth.
Thank you, Mr. Sue. Mr. Dorison?
Thank you.
I want to review that with you and see if I've got it right, that we have the existing, I just refer them shorthand, the 1972 orders. I don't know if they're both that date, but
sure.
1972 orders, they're still in place. And over the years, different things have done, but the county came up with the 2006-2007 student assignment plan and revised its policy. And the parties presented that, agreed to that, presented that to court for approval. And the court did approve that in 2009, right?
Yes.
And then, in carrying that out, the county still has the burden now of carrying it out and making it work so they get to a unitary status, right?
Yes.
And under the proposal, they will then have to demonstrate at the end of the year that they have used that 2006-2007 student assignment plan and the revised policy to achieve unitary status. Ultimately, they have the burden of demonstrating the unitary status.
Ultimately, they do have the burden, and they have that burden until then. They, as
sure.
I said earlier, they are the 2009 order.
They have the burden all the way through because the 1972 orders are still in place.
That's right.
But there is a mechanism that's been put in place by the court to try to give effect to those 1972 orders by the 2009 order, which is to start with approval of the 2006-07 student assignment plan and the revised policy, and to give them the time until the end of the year to implement the unitary policy and report and demonstrate they've done it, with the idea that ultimately they would like to lift the 72 orders, but they're still in place.
That's right.
Yeah.
And just as a point of clarification, the 2006 assignment plan has been jettisoned. The issue in this case is a 2011-2012 student assignment plan, which they purportedly adopted pursuant to the policy.
And but, with respect to that plan, I didn't hear you say when you first stood up that you intend, if this case goes back to Judge Howard, to challenge that. What you want, I understand, is an accelerated process toward achieving unitary status. But doesn't this 2009 order already have that process in place?
The 2009 order does have a process in place for reporting back to Judge Howard. But again, the order and the reporting requirement can in no way be perceived as creating some kind of bubble in which the school district can operate.
They have to demonstrate, and they're going to have to satisfy the district judge that the 1972 orders are now fulfilled.
They have to demonstrate that now. They have to demonstrate under the...
Except that you guys agreed to a timetable as to how to do it.
Well, again, we agreed to a reporting requirement. Actually, the reporting requirement was in the judge's order. It wasn't part of the settlement. But the reporting requirement we welcomed as the judge reasserting the historic oversight that the court should apply. But again, it does not, because they're still not unitary, that bright line test in all of the cases, you're either post-unitary or you're pre-unitary. And as long as you're pre-unitary, any actions that the board takes, they have the burden of demonstrating that it's moving the district towards unitary status.
If you agree, and let's make this hypothetical, so I want to embellish it a little bit.
Okay.
If you agree to an order that says on January 1st you're going to do this, they're going to do this, on March 1st they're going to do this, on April 1st they're going to do this, and we're going to have a final test October 1st. And it's all laid out, all the details. And during the course of that, and we're not going to come back to court, it says, until October 1st, and we'll see how they do. If you come back before then, and you've agreed to that timetable, shouldn't there be an issue as to whether you can come back before the timetable that you agreed to, or the arrangement you agreed to, which, in other words, it doesn't change the burdens, but the question is, are you frustrating the efforts that are in the 2006-2007 student assignment plan and now the 2011 student assignment plan, the revised policy, and the idea that they're looking forward to the end of the year to put together their proof and demonstrate that they're doing what they undertook to do?
Well, with all due...
I sort of sense it's sort of a... maybe a jumping the gun issue, is it, or
except
not?
That what they've done, this student assignment plan, as we've alleged, completely undermines their ability to be able to come back at the end of 2012 and say, we've done it, because it undermines their affirmative duty to move forward and creates immediate and irreparable harms
if
for students.
If they went back to the 2006-2007 student plan, would you be more satisfied or less?
It would depend on how they implemented it. Policy 10.17 is on paper as a policy is positive. The way they chose to implement it here, they jettisoned the use of race, they jettisoned the use of socioeconomic status, they refused to look at the entire district, ignored hyper-segregated white schools that were just omitted from the plan, rejected a less discriminatory alternative that was submitted even under the bastardized version of 10.17, they rejected a less discriminatory alternative, and they open a brand new school, Lake Forest Elementary, brand new, tabula rasa, as one of the most racially isolated, lowest performing schools
this,
in the district.
Because this is interesting. The judge here, the settlement here was in November 2009, and the settlement says, okay, but you go ahead with your assignment and you move forward. And then, pursuant to the settlement, the work then begins to then make a plan assignment. And as I understand perhaps where you're going is that we're not challenging the settlement, it's what's happening in terms, because the judge didn't have that plan assignment in front of it. And you don't get to discriminate just because you got a settlement here. You don't get to violate the 1970 order after this settlement has done, when you're having retreats and you're drawing up plans and you're drawing up all kinds of other stuff. You are still bound by the 1970 order. Because even if you accept that Judge Howard, when he had this settlement in front of him, if he had said all these plans that have already been done, we got everything here, and I'm going to approve for 2010, 2010, 2012, done, you probably wouldn't have much to say here, because he would say it was done and you didn't challenge that. But this wasn't even done when the settlement was done. What you're challenging is stuff that's being done after the settlement order that you say violates 1970 orders. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Okay, I think I understand your point.
Thank you.
Was the 2011 plan approved by the judge?
It was not. And there were members of the school board and our clients in community meetings.
The 11 plan is part of their effort to comply with the directions to move toward.
Well, we don't think it is part of their plan. They if you look at the record, they said they were adopting it to populate a new school to relieve overcrowding. There's nothing in the record that suggests this is we're picking this plan because it moves us to unitary status. There are questions from board members about it. There are questions from the public, and that issue is never addressed. And that goes to their inability to meet the affirmative burden that's been established by the school desegregation precedents.
In other words, no order controls the actions that you're talking about here. The settlement doesn't control the plan that's being sought for 2011 or 2012. Nothing else controls it, and from your perspective, it's controlled by the 1970 order, which requires them to come forth to prove that this is in compliance with it.
That's correct, and I would say the 2009 order reaffirms those 1970 orders. The court was very clear to say this district is still not unitary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then take a short recess.